Hello and welcome to OMFI's Fed Talk podcast. On this week's episode, we talk about the Federal Reserve's decision to raise interest rates, the US monetary and fiscal policies, and global developments in finance and central banking. We talk to Marcia van der Burg, Distinguished Career Fellow 2016-2017 at Stanford University, and Danai Kiriakopoulou, Chief Economist and Head of Research at OMFI. Welcome. In June, the Federal Reserve decided to raise the interest rate by a quarter point to a range of 1.75 to 2%. Their statement indicated that the economy is strengthening through growth and job creation, boosting consumer spending, and leaving Federal Reserve officials confident of further rate hikes in the future. In contrast, the Fed recently expressed their concern at growing global trade tensions and a reluctance in the business community to increase capital spending. So, Marcia, if we may start with you, how do you view last month's decision to raise interest rates?
Thank you very much for those introductions. I think the decision was not unexpected. We had the news that came out in mid-July and then the release of the minutes that followed, but it wasn't unexpected. I think what's going forward is what is so uncertain. And overall question is the United States economy going to continue as it's been? It's got very strong fundamentals. The decision was made in that context. And as you noted, with one eye over the shoulder at the darkening skies over trade and the trade war that looks to be in the offing. But the decision was made in a context of strong fundamentals with economic growth and strong job growth. And they did raise interest rates by only a quarter of a point. They raised the target date from 1.75 to 2%. So that's a very small incremental step. And I think definitely can expect at least two more, if not at least one more rate hike this year, bringing to seven the number of hikes in the current cycle, and two more this year, and then three more in 2019. And as they said in their minutes, it's consistent with the sustained expansion of economic activity and the jobs and their own inflation target of 2% over the medium term. But all in all, it was still a step that was not unexpected. It did include that cautionary note about geopolitics and the trade war that seems to be getting closer and closer as the days go by. And it raises ultimately that question of, are we going to see a soft landing, that is, final resolution to what we've been going through in the last 10 years?
Danai, what are your views on the raise in June?
Thank you, Ren, and thank you, Marcia. I mean, I agree with Marcia. I think it was largely anticipated, is in line with what we've seen by the Fed in terms of this very gradual approach to normalization. It's consistent with its objective of keeping inflation steady, and we've seen very positive economic data, so there's not been anything to disrupt that path. I think it was largely anticipated by the markets as well. And in terms of the outlook ahead, I agree. I think the Fed will probably continue on the path it set. Having said that, I think there is worries about the potential impact on the economy of the latest policy uncertainty regarding trade. We haven't seen yet how businesses react in terms of how it affects business confidence. There's also the global economic environment is changing, and that's something that the Fed acknowledged in its minutes as well in terms of the policy uncertainty that we've seen in Europe around the migration with Italy, more recently also in the UK with the latest resignations around Brexit. So it's becoming a bit of a more uncertain policy environment globally. Emerging markets as well are slowing down. So I think that's something that the Fed will bear in mind as it continues its policy for the months ahead and the years ahead. The trade war, it remains to be seen how it affects the global economy, what kind of actions are taken in retaliation. We also have the NATO summit where we'll see those global tensions present again. And I think the question is also whether the trade war leads to a global recession or not, and how that will impact the dollar, because capital tends to return to safety, tends to return to the dollar in those occasions. So strangely, it could even be that capital goes back to the US in that situation. So I think it's something definitely to watch, the trade war and its political implications as well, of how they affect the political situation in the US, but also the relationship between government and the Fed.
So going to inflation for a moment, given that inflation is now at 2.8% and it's looking to be rising still, how effective do you think the Fed's policy is at the moment? What else could it be doing? But also, how confident can it be about its projections for the future given the uncertainties you've just outlined?
Well, the Fed judges that the economy is not really close to overheating. And I would agree with that assessment. I think it's about gradually normalizing policy. And it's also about this asymmetry in terms of the deviation from the target. It's something that central banks have for years been battling inflation and then more recently battling deflation and very low inflation. So I think there is a danger of tightening too soon. It's also a question of whether tightening too much and too quickly would create a slowing economy and how that would affect the midterm election results, the next round of presidential elections. I think the Fed would not want to go there. And ultimately, its policy is very data dependent. So far, we're seeing strong data, but there are risks on the horizon. Inflation, yes, above the target, but it's nowhere near the overheating. And there's still parts of the economy that are facing risks. So I don't think the Fed will change its path to be raising rates more quickly than it has indicated.
Well, I just might add that I think the Fed is on a track that's unlikely to change, as we both noted. And I would add to that, that at its next meeting, it should have its full complement of membership. There are two nominations pending. I believe there's hearings in July, confirmation hearings for the two more recent appointees. John Williams, I believe, is in place as head of the New York Fed. And so you should have a full complement, but there's no indication that those nominees and then John Williams, who's spoken out in favor of rate increases, there's no indication that the Fed would change its direction in any way, shape, or form. I think the bigger worry, and it's not really a worry, because I think if you look at the integrity of the people who are both in place and who have been nominated, the Fed's independence, I think we can be reasonably assured that that's the case. That doesn't mean that they're, of course, not making their decisions. They'll be making them in the context of a very heated midterm elections. But I expect the Fed to probably not veer from its course unless the economy makes some rapid change in direction between now and then. And like Danai pointed out, the global circumstances are certainly creating different size waves in that turmoil. But once again, the fundamentals here in the U.S. are so very strong that that leaves the U.S. in a fairly strong position.
If we look at the Board of Governors, at the moment, only 3 out of 7 positions are actually filled. And can we expect President Trump to appoint a new governors that are from Republican background? And what would that tell us about the link between his fiscal policy and monetary policy, especially in view of unwinding balance sheets as well, the Federal Reserve and an expansionary fiscal policy?
Well, as I noted, Rand, there are two nominees in the wings. One is Richard Clarida, who's an economist and advisor to PIMCO and has a reputation. He's known to be a conservative monetary policy guy, but he's not expected to face much opposition. The other person who's been appointed is a woman from Kansas, a commissioner of banking, and her name is Michelle Bowman. She is appointed to a new position, not a new seat, but a new position within the Fed Board complement. And she represents small regional banks across the country. It's a new position that is one of the results of the Dodd-Frank legislation. She will take her place, but she does not have strong monetary views, and yet she'll be talking about monetary policy. So that could be some bit of a challenge there. And then you have, like I said, John Williams in New York. He's succeeding William Dudley, and he'll have a position. So I think you'll have, what I say, a full complement of decision makers. And there's no indication at this point that they are going to be in direction other than what we're seeing under the Powell, the last two decisions that the Powell Fed has made. I don't see any change unless things make a dramatic turn.
Yeah, just to add to the point about the mix between monetary and fiscal policy as well that you asked, Ren, I think it's quite strange to be seeing that mix of expansionary fiscal policy, especially at a time when the U.S. economy is doing quite well. And it also seems incompatible with the president's policies in terms of his trade policy, because there is the risk of the U.S. returning to a twin deficit situation, because when you're expanding the deficit, in effect encouraging spending rather than saving, you could have a widening of the trade deficit, which would then require even more of these type of policies in retaliation and more protectionist attitude. So that's something that is quite concerning in terms of fiscal policy. But I think the path for monetary policy is very clear. year in terms of normalization. I think that's something that we're seeing globally with central banks as well. And in case there is a next recession, they need to have room to be able to cut further again, because let's not forget, we're quite late in the economic cycle. These things do not come by appointment, of course, but there is sufficient historic evidence to suggest that it's quite unusual for a bull market to have lasted for so long. So I think the Fed is right to be cautious and to want to have some room for maneuver in any eventuality, especially in this highly uncertain environment geopolitically, with the NATO summit, with the trade wars, with where we are in Europe and Brexit. I think that's quite cautious approach is justified.
I just might add, you asked about the fiscal policy of administration. There are some who might say there really is no fiscal policy per se in the classic sense of that. There is a stimulus policy, and I think the many economists and others are not yet agreed that the tax cut was the best policy, that the U.S. tax cuts that the Congress enacted was not the best policy in the world for the United States. I mean, that debate is still out. I might add that the debate is still undertaken by economists as to the 1986 tax reforms under President Reagan. That debate is still continuing. But the value of that Trump tax reform package and the size of the increase in the deficit that's been projected as a result, without any countervailing cuts to keep us sort of in a fiscal parameters that make good sound sense, is not only an economic issue, but also a political issue going forward.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think it would be good to hear both your views as well on the current unemployment situation in the US. Of course, unemployment is very low. It's near full employment at the moment. It would be interesting as well to hear your views on current wage growth and what that means for Trump's approval ratings, and whether his, as you say, fiscal stimulus package is actually being viewed by the majority of people in the US as a positive thing.
Well, there's an interesting confluence going on between the corporate tax cuts and then the repatriation of assets overseas and what corporations are doing with those assets. And the question is, are they putting that money back into wage growth, into research and expanding their base of operations? It's not clear. There's kind of a mixed picture, but there is some criticism out there of some of the corporate share buybacks, substantial bit of the money being used for corporate share buybacks and dividends, and if that is really having the intended effect that would keep the larger U.S. economy on a sustained growth. And then you have the question of whether there is room within the economy for expansion beyond the current expansion rate. Could this economy grow at a 2% a year for the next 2 or 3 years? Does it have that kind of capacity for that size growth? And, you know, that when you've got that balance, that equilibrium, that is always the goal at the end of the day. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is you've got near full employment, you've got assets coming back into corporations. What they're doing with those assets, are they trying to grow their base? Are they able to grow their base? And what the outlook for the ongoing growth of the U.S. economy?
Yes, I mean, in terms of where the fundamentals are in the labor market in the U.S., it is strong. We've seen strong jobs data, but there are fragilities, especially in terms of the asset price inflation that we've seen, financial markets, where they are, how that could be impacted and how that cycle could turn, especially as monetary policy normalizes, I think is a big risk. Also, going back again to the trade wars, because I think that is the biggest issue for the U.S. economy at the moment. And let's not forget that a lot of the measures that China is doing in retaliation or even the EU are targeted at the areas where Trump has supporters, because you asked about how that will impact his ratings. And I think US is a democracy. The political system is much more fluid than in China, where when you have these kind of actions, they're not likely to affect President Xi's popularity or agenda as much as they could in the US. So the risk of political uncertainty of disruption is much higher. And there's all sorts of things that China could do. It could suddenly close a US factory for inspections. It doesn't have to do it through tariffs and through retaliatory measures that the WTO or anyone else may scrutinize. So there's all sorts of ways to do that. And even if American workers are not directly affected by that, it will channel through back to them. So I think it is fragility, it is a risk, and we shouldn't get complacent by the strong jobs data that we're seeing at the moment.
And continuing on that theme of the impact of the trade war, with, of course, tariffs on certain goods, with the increase in interest rates, with inflation heading towards 3%, with perhaps growing inequality as well in the US, what do you think the implications are of the trade war in the wider economic environment? What are the implications for US consumers and their purchasing power? And again, what does that do for the approval ratings of Trump?
Well, you know, it's on the approval ratings, Rand. It's very interesting. The ratings haven't moved much for a president in an economy that's as strong as this economy. They haven't moved much between the 37 to 40, 41% range. And for a president in a strong economy like we have now, those ratings, one could argue, could be a good bit higher. That said, you have a very interesting circumstance where the president, as a Republican president, is advocating one approach, this being the trade war, versus the traditional Republican position of being very, very pro-trade. And his actions and his language seem to suggest that these Republicans should not balk, they should follow, and they should fall in line. And there's been, that I think caused a good bit of consternation within the leadership as well as the rank and file elected Republican. But there's, going into the midterms, there's some larger fear that they could be politically vulnerable if they do not bend to what Trump is advocating. So there's that element. And then there's another element within the Republican Party that is saying, yes, we know this is going to hurt different constituencies across the country, but give him a chance. Let's see if this approach can work. So there is that kind of debate. And of course, the Democrats have their position as well. As to the impact on the economy, I think what is, you know, the economy is so strong overall, and the market is not saying that the tariffs are good or bad. They're just kind of saying that the economy as a whole is not going to feel the impact. But that does not reflect that there's going to be constituencies, different groups, soybean farmers, manufacturers of small electrical equipment, technology, and different aspects of a larger economy that are not going to feel the implications of the tariffs against Canada. Canada's retaliated, the tariffs against China. China is playing its cards very close to its chest. There's talk now, as we sit here, of more tariffs against China. We'll have hearings later on in July about tariffs against imported cars. So we don't know the direction that that's going. People are holding their breath on that score. So I think the impact is going to be piecemeal, if you will. It's going to be at different constituencies. And once again, all mindful that those midterms are in the offing. The Democrats are in a good position. There's a lot of conversation about whether they can take back the House. That possibility looks to be a little bit stronger than getting control of the Senate, given the numbers, number of seats that are in play on both sides of the Congress. So we'll just see. But in the short term, we just have to take it almost day by day. At White House, that's extremely unpredictable, except on trade policy. He's been very, very consistent at the core. He's a mercantilist to the core, and he's been very consistent about trade.
Yes, to echo what Marcia said, I think it's absolutely remarkable that Trump's approval ratings have been so steady at around 40%, especially when one considers how unpredictable, how much uncertainty there is around the policies. But I suspect they've not been as steady when you think about his approvals globally rather than within the US. And to take it back to the risks for the global economy, I think given where Europe is with the uncertainties around Italy, with the risk of a sovereign debt crisis coming back in that case, with the tensions around Brexit, the tensions politically, and also the upcoming European Parliament elections in May 2019, Europe doesn't want to have another thing in its agenda, and that being Trump and the US, one of its closest allies, now drifting apart. And maybe if that leads to a global recession, the trade wars, then that would force closer cooperation between the US and Europe, especially given the alliances that are forming on the other side with China, Russia, even Middle Eastern economies, Turkey, and so on. It's becoming a very unilateral world arena, and I think it's a very bad time to be isolated, especially if the economic repercussions are that severe. So I think it's definitely something to watch in that area.
It's just really difficult to approach the global economy as a global economy and to approach world politics as increasingly anything other than a series of domestic interests. I mean, it is a very changing place, if you will. And Ren, you asked earlier about the impact of what's happening with US dollar and the impact that's happening. I think you look across emerging markets, and many of us talk about the impact on emerging market currencies and emerging market economies, particularly those that are over leveraged in dollar denominated loans, but it's hard to give a blanket response that is blanket over and referencing all emerging markets. I mean, you have to take each one individually, take into context their domestic considerations, what is happening, to really understand. It's going to make the job of people like Danai and myself much tougher going forward, but it is a very, very changing world in terms of the drivers and direction those drivers are taking. I mean, Danai pointed out the conversations that are taking place between Anglo America and the Chinese in the Middle East and other places, and different alliances are shifting ever so subtly or not subtly, and it's just a very different place.
Yes, absolutely. We can't treat all economies the same, all emerging markets the same. I think we are far from that. Now we've come a long way since, for example, the Asian crisis, where we had this herding behavior and a whole region was seen as the same, or even more recently in the euro area, treating the periphery as having similar problems. I think now investors are much more sophisticated, and emerging markets as well are much better prepared. I mean, we had the taper tantrum at the time of Bernanke, but still now a lot of the debt is denominated in local currency. They're much more resilient. They have current account surpluses instead of deficits. So we're in a much better place than at the time of the Asian crisis, or even more recently. There's been resilience. There's a higher level of foreign exchange reserves by emerging markets, although, of course, there is never enough reserves, because once the currency comes under threat, then it's not about how much you have, but whether you have to use them or not. But at the same time, there seems to be some level of confidence from emerging markets that they can withstand the normalization of monetary policy in the US. Now, whether they can withstand the global trade war, it depends how far that goes. So I think we still need to be cautious. But overall, I think there is resilience.
I think that's been very helpful. Marsha, one last point I'd like to touch upon is 2020 and the prospect of Donald Trump standing again for the presidency. What do you think the likelihood is of his re-election, given as well the global uncertainties you've just sketched, unilateral world order perhaps, and the establishment candidates winning in several countries like Italy, Mexico, perhaps even a bigger populist vote in Germany as well? What are the prospects of Trump winning another election?
Well, I think the prospect of his running are very strong. I think he's given no indication he intends not to run. There are some things that could derail that. The Mueller investigation continues. There could be a change in his base. But up to now, he's run, for as erratic as his White House is, and for putting aside the style with which he's run the presidency. And what I mean, the way he communicates with the American people, the utter lack of truthfulness, really, in speaking to the American people, putting all of those things aside and any other descriptions of him as a candidate. He has run a very smart White House in terms of creating for himself a platform for re-election. He has stayed consistently mindful of what he sees his base and his base's thinking and position and this base's support. He hasn't done anything that could jeopardize that. If anything, he's fueled it. He's been consistent in that respect. So I think there's no question but that he intends to run again. And I think that there's very few who would expect him to say he's only going to be a one-term president.
Marsha, Danai, thank you both very much for your input. If you've enjoyed the program, then please do leave us a review.